accept Jaime's explanations and consolation. He soon mastered his right hand and expanded his use of the two fingers that remained, continuing to compose songs about hens and hunted foxes. One day he was invited to appear on a radio program, which was the beginning of a giddy popularity he had never expected. His voice began to be heard often on the radio, and his name became known. But Senator Trueba never heard it, because he did not allow radios in his house. He viewed them as instruments for the uneducated and the purveyors of sinister influences and vulgar ideas. No one was further removed from popular music than he was. The only melody he could stand to listen to was the sound of opera during the season and the zarzuela company that came from Spain each winter. The day Jaime came home with the news that he wanted to change his last name because ever since his father had been a senator in the Conservative Party, his fellow students at the university had been harassing him and the poor people in the Misericordia district no longer trusted him. Esteban Trueba lost his temper and was about to slap him when he realized that this time his son would not tolerate it. "I married so I would have legitimate sons to bear my name, not bastards with their mothers," he roared, livid with rage. 2 weeks later, it was whispered in the corridors of Congress and the sitting rooms of the club that his son Jaime had pulled off his pants in the middle of the Plaza Brasil to give them to a beggar and had walked the 15 blocks back to his house in his underwear, followed by a bevy of children and curious observers who cheered him on. Tired of defending his honor from ridicule and gossip, Esteban allowed his son to take whatever name he wanted, provided that it not be his own. That day, locked in his study, he wept with disappointment and rage. He tried to tell himself that his son's eccentricities would disappear with age, and that sooner or later he would become a well-adjusted man who would join him in his business and become his support in his old age. With his other son, he had given up hope. Nicolás went from one fantastic enterprise to another. His chief ambition at this point was to cross the Cordillera in an unusual form of transportation, just as his uncle Marcos had tried to do many years before. He had chosen to rise in a balloon, convinced that the spectacle of a gigantic balloon suspended in the clouds would be an irresistible form of publicity for almost any carbonated drink. He copied the model of a pre-war German Zeppelin, which lifted off by means of a hot air system and could accommodate one or more passengers endowed with adventurous temperaments. His zeal to construct that enormous inflatable sausage and to learn all its secret mechanisms, as well as to study wind currents, the predictions of his cards, and the laws of aerodynamics, kept him busy for quite some time. Weeks passed, and he forgot all about the Friday spiritualist sessions with his mother and the three Mora sisters, and did not even notice that Amanda had stopped coming to the house. Once his flying ship was finished, he found himself face to face with an unexpected obstacle. The manager of the soda company, a gringo from Arkansas, refused to finance his project, arguing that if Nicolás was killed in his machine, sales of his beverage would decline. Nicolás tried to find other sponsors, but no one was interested. That did not dissuade him from his enterprise. He decided to go up anyway, even if his trip was unpaid for. On the appointed day, Clara continued her knitting unperturbed without noticing her son's preparations, even though her family, friends, and neighbors were all horrified at the insane plan of crossing the mountains in that outlandish contraption. "I have a hunch it isn't going to take off," said Clara without looking up from her knitting. And she was right. At the last minute, a truck full of policemen drove up beside the public park that Nicolás had chosen as his airfield. They demanded a city permit, which, of course, he did not have, nor was he able to obtain one. He spent 4 days rushing from one office to the next in a series of desperate maneuvers that all ran up against the same wall of bureaucratic incomprehension. He never found out that behind the police truck and the interminable paperwork was his father's influence, because his father was damned if he was going to permit such an adventure. Weary of fighting the timidity of the soda company and the aerial bureaucracy, Nicolás became convinced that the balloon would never rise unless he did it surreptitiously, which was impossible given the dimensions of his ship. He suffered an anxiety attack, from which his mother rescued him by suggesting that in order not to lose his investment, he try to think of some practical use for the material he had used to build his balloon. It was then that Nicolás had the idea of the sandwich factory. His plan was to make chicken sandwiches, wrap them in the pieces of balloon skin, and sell them to office workers. The large kitchen of his house seemed to him ideal for this purpose. The gardens soon filled with birds whose legs had been laced together, waiting their turn to be decapitated by the two butchers specially hired for that purpose. The courtyard filled with feathers, and the Olympian statues were splattered with blood. The smell of consommé had made everyone nauseated, and the table used to gut the birds had begun to fill the whole neighborhood with flies when Clara brought an end to the slaughter with an attack of nerves that almost thrust her back to the days of muteness. This second commercial failure was less important to Nicolás, whose stomach and conscience had also been upset by the slaughter. He resigned himself to losing whatever he had invested in these schemes and locked himself in his room to plan new ways to make money and amuse himself. "It's been a while since I've seen Amanda around here," Jaime said when he could no longer stand the impatience of his heart. Then Nicolás remembered Amanda and realized he had not seen her in the house for at least 3 weeks, and that she had not been present at either the failed balloon attempt or the inauguration of the domestic production of bread with chicken. He went to ask Clara, but his mother also knew nothing of the girl and had begun to forget her. She had been forced to accept the fact that her house was now a way station and, as she put it, she did not have soul enough to worry about all these people who were absent. Nicolás decided to go look for her, because he realized that he missed the anxious butterfly of her presence and her silent, suffocating embraces in the empty rooms of the big house on the corner, where they thrashed around like puppies every time Clara let her guard down and Miguel was off playing or asleep in some corner. The pension where Amanda lived with her little brother turned out to be a moldering old house that 50 years earlier had probably boasted some ostentatious splendor, but had lost it as the city gradually expanded to the foothills of the Cordillera. At first, it had been occupied by Arab merchants who encrusted it with pink friezes. Later, when the Arabs moved their business to the Turkish quarter, the owner had turned it into a boarding house, subdividing it into poorly lit, sad, uncomfortable, and awkwardly constructed rooms for tenants of little means. It had an impossible labyrinth of dark, narrow halls in which the stink of cauliflower soup and cabbage stew reigned eternally. The owner of the place came out to open the door in person. She was an immense mountain of a woman, endowed with a majestic triple chin and tiny oriental eyes sunk in folds congealed with grease. She wore rings on all her fingers and used the affected gestures of a novice. "We don't accept visitors of the opposite sex," she told Nicolás. But Nicolás unfurled his irresistible seducer smile, kissed her on the hand without jumping back at the sight of her filthy, chipped vermilion fingernails, went into ecstasies over her rings, and passed himself off as a first cousin of Amanda's until the woman, defeated and twisting her mouth into flirtatious smiles and elephantine contortions, led him up the dusty stairs to the third floor and pointed to Amanda's door. Nicolás found the young girl in her bed, wrapped in a discolored shawl, playing checkers with her brother Miguel. She was so green and slight that it was hard for him to recognize her. Amanda stared at him without smiling and made no sign of welcome. Miguel, however, stood in front of him with his hands on his hips. "You finally came," the child said. Nicolas walked to the bed and tried to recall the dark, supple Amanda, the fruity, sinuous Amanda of their encounters in the darkness of the locked rooms. But between the caked wool of the shawl and the gray sheets, there was a strange woman with huge, lost eyes who was staring at him with inexplicable harshness. "Amanda," he murmured, taking her by the hand. Without its silver rings and bracelets, the hand looked as weak as the leg of a dying bird. Amanda called her brother. Miguel went to the bed and she whispered something in his ear. The boy walked slowly toward the door. From the threshold, he shot Nicolas a furious departing look and walked out, shutting the door noiselessly behind him. "Forgive me, Amanda," Nicolas said. "I was very busy. Why didn't you tell me you were sick?" "I'm not sick," she replied. "I'm pregnant." That word hit Nicolas like a slap. He stepped back until he felt the glass of the window behind his shoulders. From the very first time he had undressed Amanda, fumbling his way in the darkness, tangled in the rags of her existentialist disguise, trembling with anticipation as he felt the protuberances and interstices that he so often imagined without ever knowing them in all their splendid nakedness. He had assumed that she had sufficient experience to avoid making him a father at 21 and herself an unwed mother at 25. Amanda had had other loves before and had been the first person to speak to him of free love. She insisted on her unequivocal determination for them to remain together only so long as they were friends, without constraints or promises for the future, just like Sartre and Beauvoir. This agreement, which to Nicolas had first seemed like a shocking sign of coldness and distance, turned out to be to his advantage. Relaxed and happy as he was about everything in life, he let himself fall in love without thinking of the consequences.
"Now what are we going to do?" he exclaimed.
"An abortion, of course," she replied. A wave of relief broke over Nicolas. He had sidestepped the abyss yet one more time. As always happened when he was playing alongside a precipice, someone stronger than himself had risen up beside him to take charge of things. Just like the times at school, when he would taunt the other boys until they jumped on top of him, and then, at the very last possible minute, when he was paralyzed with terror, Jaime would appear and stand in front of him, changing his panic to euphoria, and allowing him to run for cover behind the pillars of the courtyard and shout insults from his refuge, while his brother bled from his nose and delivered punches with the silent tenacity of a machine. Now Amanda was taking responsibility for him.
"We can get married, Amanda, if you want," he stammered to save face.
"No," she answered without hesitation. "I don't love you enough for that, Nicolas." His feelings immediately swerved, for that possibility had not occurred to him. Up until that point, he had never felt rejected or abandoned, and in each of his affairs he had had to resort to all his tact to disengage himself without hurting the girl. He thought about the difficult situation Amanda now faced, poor, alone, and expecting a child. One word from him could change her fate, converting her into the respectable wife of a Trueba. These calculations flashed through his mind in a fraction of a second, but he immediately felt ashamed and blushed at catching himself in such thoughts. Suddenly, Amanda looked magnificent to him. He remembered all the wonderful moments they had shared, the times they had lain on the floor smoking the same pipe to get high together, laughing at that grass that tasted like dried dung and had hardly any hallucinogenic effect, but did activate the power of suggestion. The yoga exercises and meditations they had performed as a couple, seated face to face in complete relaxation, staring into each other's eyes and murmuring Sanskrit words that could send them all the way to nirvana, but that generally had the opposite effect, and they would wind up slipping out of other people's sight, stretched out beneath the tall reeds in the garden, desperately making love. The books they had read by candlelight, drowning in passion and smoke. The interminable gatherings during which they discussed the pessimistic post-war philosophers or concentrated on trying to move the three-legged table, two taps for yes, three for no, while Clara laughed at them. He fell to his knees beside the bed, begging Amanda not to leave him, to forgive him, to let them go on as if nothing had happened, because this was simply an unfortunate accident that could not affect the untouchable essence of their relationship. But she seemed not to listen. She was caressing his hair with a maternal, distracted air. "It's no use, Nicolas," she said. "Can't you see my soul is very old and you're still a child? You'll always be a child." They continued to caress each other without desire, torturing themselves with pleas and memories. They were savoring the bitterness of a parting that they could already sense but could still confuse with a reconciliation. She got up from bed to prepare them both some tea, and Nicolas saw that she was using an old slip as a nightgown. She had lost weight, and her skinny calves invited his pity. She walked barefoot in the room, with the shawl over her shoulders and her hair unkempt, hovering over the little kerosene stove she kept perched on the single table that served as her dining room table, her desk, and her kitchen table. He saw the disorder Amanda lived in and realized that until then he had known almost nothing about her. He had assumed that she had no other family besides her brother and that she lived on a small salary, but he had never imagined her actual situation. Poverty to him was an abstract, distant concept, applicable to the tenants at Tres Marias and the indigent patients his brother Jaime helped. He had never had any direct contact with it himself. Amanda, his Amanda, so close and so well known, suddenly became a stranger. He glanced at her clothes, which looked like the garments of a queen when she had them on, but now, hanging from their nails on the wall, seemed like the sad rags of a beggar. He looked at her toothbrush in a glass above the rusty sink, Miguel's school shoes that had been blackened and re-blackened so many times that they lost their shape, at the old typewriter beside the stove, the books lying among the coffee cups, the broken window patched with newspaper. It was another world, a world whose existence he had not even suspected. Until that moment, there had been a dividing line on one side of which stood the solemn poor, and on the other, people like himself, among whom he had classed Amanda. He knew nothing of that silent middle class that struggled between genteel poverty and the impossible desire of emulating the golden canaille to which he himself belonged. He felt confused and embarrassed, thinking of the many occasions in the past when she must have had to use witchcraft to keep her poverty from being noticed at the Truevas, and he, in his complete innocence, hadn't helped her. He remembered his father's stories about his poor childhood and how at Nicolás's age he was already out working to support his mother and sister. For the first time in his life, he managed to link those didactic anecdotes with a reality he could see. He thought Amanda's life must be like that. They shared a cup of tea sitting on the bed, because there was only one chair. Amanda told him about her past, her family, her alcoholic father who had been a teacher in one of the northern provinces, her sad, overworked mother who had to support six children, and how, as soon as she was able to stand on her own two feet, she had run away from home. She had reached the capital when she was only 15, arriving at the house of a generous godmother who helped her for a while. Later, when her mother died, she had gone to bury her and bring back Miguel, who was still in diapers. She had been his mother ever since. She had no idea what had become of her father and of her brothers and sisters, Nicolás felt a rising desire to protect her and take care of her, to make up for everything. He had never loved her more. At dusk, Miguel arrived with ruddy cheeks, squirming in silent amusement to hide the present he was holding behind his back. It was a paper sack of bread for his sister. He put it on the bed, kissed her tenderly, smoothed her hair with his tiny hands, and straightened the pillows. Nicolás shuddered. There was more tenderness and love in the gestures of that little boy than in all the caresses he had showered on any woman in his life. Only then did he understand what Amanda had meant.
"I have a lot to learn," he murmured.
He leaned his forehead against the greasy pane of the window, wondering whether he would ever be able to give as much as he hoped to receive.
"How are we going to do it?"
he asked, not daring to pronounce the terrible word.
"Ask your brother Jaime for help," Amanda suggested.
Jaime received his brother in his tunnel of books, lying on his cot in the light of the solitary bulb that hung directly above him from the ceiling. He was reading the love sonnets of the poet, who was by now a world-renowned figure, as Clara had predicted the first time she heard him recite in his telluric voice at one of her literary soirees. He wondered whether the sonnets might not have been inspired by Amanda's presence in the Trueba garden, where the poet liked to sit at tea time and talk about songs of despair. During the period when he had been an assiduous visitor at the big house on the corner. He was surprised to see Nicolás, because since they had finished school, he and his brother had daily grown further apart. Most recently, they'd had nothing to say to each other, and on the rare occasions when they met on the doorstep, they had merely exchanged nods. Jaime had given up on the idea of drawing Nicolás into transcendental matters of existence. He still took his brother's frivolous activities as a personal affront, for he could not accept the fact that Nicolás could waste his time and energy on balloon rides and the slaughter of chickens when there was so much work to be done in the Misericordia district. But he no longer tried to drag him to the hospital to make him look at suffering up close, hoping against hope that the pain of others might move his bird of passage heart. And he had stopped inviting him to the socialist meetings at Pedro Tercero Garcia's house on the last street of the working-class district, where they all gathered every Thursday under the eye of the police. Nicolás made fun of his social concerns, arguing that only a fool with a calling of an apostle would go out into the world seeking misery and ugliness with the stump of a candle. Now Jaime's brother stood before him, staring at him with the guilty, pleading look he had used so many times to enlist his affection. "Amanda's pregnant," Nicolás said without preamble. He had to repeat himself, because Jaime did not move, remaining as unresponsive as ever, without the slightest gesture to show that he had heard his brother's words. But inside, his frustration was choking him. Silently, he called Amanda's name, clutching the sweet echo of the word in order not to lose control. So fierce was his need to hold on to his illusions that he had managed to convince himself that the love between Amanda and his brother was completely juvenile and limited to innocent strolls on which they walked hand in hand, to discussions over a bottle of absinthe, and to the few fleeting kisses he had glimpsed over the years. He had refused to admit the painful truth that was now confronting him.
"Don't tell me about it. It's no business of mine," he replied as soon as he was able to speak.
Nicolás collapsed onto the end of the bed, burying his face in his hands.
"Please, you've got to help her," he begged.
Jaime closed his eyes and inhaled with difficulty, forcing himself to contain the wild feelings that made him want to kill his brother, to run and marry Amanda himself, to weep in impotence and disappointment. He had an image of her in his mind, the same image that appeared to him whenever he was racked by feelings of love. He saw her entering and leaving the house like a gust of fresh air,
leading her little brother by the hand. He heard her laughter on the terrace and smelled the sweet, subtle aroma of her skin and hair when she walked past him in the midday sun. He saw her as he imagined her in all the idle hours he spent dreaming of her. Above all, he thought of her at the precise moment when she entered his bedroom and they were alone together in the intimacy of his refuge. She entered without knocking, while he was reading in bed, filling his burrow with the flutter of her long hair and undulating arms. She touched his books without the slightest sign of reverence, and even dared to take them from their sacred shelves. She blew the dust off their covers without the least respect and tossed them onto the bed, chatting all the while as he trembled with desire and surprise, unable to extract from his whole encyclopedic vocabulary a single word to hold her there, until she finally took leave of him with a kiss on the cheek that continued to burn. A single, terrible kiss on which he built a labyrinth of dreams where the two of them were a prince and princess hopelessly in love.
"You know about medicine, Jaime," Nicolás pleaded. "You've got to do something."
"I'm only a student. I have a long way to go before I'm a doctor. I don't know anything about all that. And I've seen a lot of women die because some ignoramus got his hands on them."
"She trusts you. She says you're the only one who can help her," Nicolás replied.
Jaime grabbed his brother by the lapels and lifted him off the floor, shaking him like a puppet and hurling every insult he could think of at him, until his own sobs obliged him to set him down. Nicolás whimpered in relief. He knew his brother, and his intuition told him that, as always, he had decided to accept the role of protector.
"Thank you, Jaime."
Jaime gave him a listless slap on the back and pushed him out of his room. He turned his key in the lock and lay face down on his cot, shaken by the hoarse, terrible moans by which men weep for love. They waited until Sunday. Jaime agreed to see them in the clinic of the Misericordia district, where he was taking his training as a doctor. He had the key because he was always the last to leave, so he could get in with ease. But he felt like a thief because he would not be able to explain his presence there at such a time. For the previous 3 days, he had done nothing but study every step of the operation he was about to perform. He could repeat each word of the book in perfect order, but that did not bolster his confidence. He was shaking like a leaf. He tried not to think of all the women he had seen in the emergency room, those he had helped to save in this very examining room, and those who had died in these very beds, white as sheets, with a river of blood flowing between their legs, and his science powerless to stop their life from running out of that open faucet. He had seen this drama close up, but until this moment he had never had to face the moral conflict of helping a desperate woman, much less Amanda. He turned on the lights, donned the white tunic of his profession, and prepared his instruments, repeating aloud every detail he had memorized. He prayed for some monumental disaster to occur, some cataclysm that would shake the planet to its core, so that he would not have to do what he was about to do. But nothing happened until the appointed hour. Meanwhile, Nicolás had gone to fetch Amanda in old Covadonga, which still ran, though it barely sputtered along on its remaining nuts and bolts, lost in a black cloud of burning oil. She was waiting for him, seated in her chair, holding Miguel's hand, the two of them deep in a mutual complicity from which, as always, Nicolás felt excluded. Amanda looked pale and emaciated after all the ups and downs of the last uncertain weeks, but she was calmer than Nicolás, who was practically incoherent and could not keep still, trying to cheer her with a false hilarity and pointless jokes. He had brought her an old ring with garnets and diamonds that he had taken from his mother's room, knowing full well that she would never miss it, and that, even if she saw it on Amanda's hand, she would never recognize it because Clara could not keep track of things like that. Amanda gently returned it.
You see, Nicolas, she said, unsmiling, you're still a child.
When it came time to leave, little Miguel put on a poncho and held tight to his sister's hand. Nicolas had to use all his charm and then brute strength to deposit him with the owner of the house, who in the past few days had been completely won over by the supposed cousin of her tenant and had, much against her will, agreed to look after the child for the evening. They drove in silence, each lost in his own fear. To Nicolas, Amanda's hostility was like a pestilence that had descended between them. In the past few days, she had begun to dwell on the idea of death, which she feared less than the pain and humiliation she would have to face that night. He steered Covadonga through an unfamiliar section of the city, down dark back streets in which garbage was piled against the walls of factories, in a forest of smokestacks that shut out the sky. Stray dogs sniffed at the grime, and beggars wrapped in newspaper slept in the doorways. He was startled that this should be the scene of his brother's daily activities. Jaime was waiting for them in front of the clinic. His white smock and his own anxiety made him look much older than he was. He led them through a labyrinth of icy corridors to the room he had prepared, doing his best to distract Amanda from the ugliness of the place. He did not want her to notice the bins full of yellowed towels waiting to be washed on Monday, the graffiti on the walls, the loose tiles, and the rusty pipes that dripped continuously. Amanda stopped with a look of horror when they came to the door of the operating room. She had seen the instruments and the gynecological table. What until then had been an abstraction, a mere flirtation with the possibility of death, suddenly materialized before her. Nicolas was pale, but Jaime took them both by the arm and led them through the door. "Don't look, Amanda," he told her. "I'm going to put you to sleep." He had never administered anesthesia or performed a surgical operation. As a student, his work was confined to administrative tasks, record-keeping, and providing assistance in treatment, suturing, and other minor tasks. He was even more afraid than Amanda. But to make her think this was all routine, he adopted the relaxed, pompous air he had seen doctors use. To spare her the embarrassment of undressing before him, and to spare himself the pain of seeing her in the nude, he helped her lie down fully dressed on the operating table. While he washed his hands and showed Nicolas how to wash his too, he tried to distract her with the anecdote about the Spanish ghost that had appeared to Clara during one of the Friday evening sessions, bringing word of a treasure buried in the foundations of the house. And he told her about his family, a collection of eccentric lunatics for several generations, whom even ghosts made fun of. But Amanda was not listening. She was as white as a sheet, and her teeth were chattering. "What are these straps for?" she asked. "I don't want to be tied down." "I'm not going to tie you down. Nicolas is going to give you the ether. Breathe normally. Don't get frightened. And when you wake up, it will all be over," Jaime told her, his eyes smiling above his mask. Nicolas brought the anesthesia mask over to Amanda. The last thing she saw before slipping into darkness was Jaime looking at her with such love in his eyes that she thought she must be dreaming. Nicolas removed her clothes and strapped her to the table, aware that this was even worse than rape, while his brother waited with gloved hands, trying not to see in her the woman of his dreams, but only a body like so many others that crossed this table every day with screams of pain. He began to work slowly and carefully, telling himself again exactly what he had to do, mumbling the words he had learned by heart as the sweat poured down onto his eyes. He was keenly aware of the girl's breathing, the color of her skin, the rhythm of her heart, so that he could signal to his brother to increase the ether every time she moaned, praying that no complications would arise as he probed deeply into her most secret parts, never for a moment ceasing to curse his brother in his thoughts. For if this child had been his instead of Nicolás's, it would have been born healthy and intact, instead of exiting in bits and pieces in the sewer of a clinic. He would have cradled it and protected it instead of extracting it from its nest with a scoop. 25 minutes later, he was finished. He ordered Nicolás to help him with her until the effects of the ether had worn off. But when he looked up, he saw that his brother was slumped against the wall, retching violently. "Idiot!" Jaime roared. "Go to the bathroom, and when you've finished puking up your guilt, wait for me outside, because we still have a long way to go." Nicolás staggered out, and Jaime took off his mask and gloves and proceeded to loosen Amanda's straps, gently slip on her clothes, hide the bloody traces of his work, and remove the instruments of torture from her sight. Then he lifted her in his arms, treasuring this moment in which he could clasp her to his chest, and carried her to a bed he had already made up with clean sheets, which was more than the women who usually came for help received. He covered her and sat down beside her. For the first time in his life, he was able to observe her at his leisure. She was smaller and sweeter than she looked when she was running around in her fortune-teller's costume and her armfuls of bracelets, and as he had imagined, the bones in her slender body were barely hinted at between the tiny hills and smooth alleys of her femininity. Without her scandalous mane of hair and her sphinx eyes, she looked 15. To Jaime, her vulnerability was more seductive than anything that had attracted him before. He felt twice as large, twice as heavy, and 1,000 times stronger. But he knew he was defeated from the start because of the tenderness he felt and his desire to protect her. He cursed his invincible sentimentality and tried to see her as his brother's lover, a woman on whom he had just performed an abortion. But he immediately realized how impossible that was, and surrendered to the pleasure and suffering of loving her. He stroked her transparent hands, her slender fingers, the shells of her ears, and ran his hands over her neck, listening to the imperceptible sound of the life inside her veins. He moved his mouth close to her lips and eagerly inhaled the scent of anesthesia, but he was not bold enough to touch them. Amanda slowly emerged from sleep. First, she felt cold, and then she was seized by a fit of retching. Jaime comforted her by speaking to her in the same secret language he reserved for animals and for the smallest children in the hospital, until she gradually relaxed. She began to cry, and he continued to caress her. They remained silent as she wavered between sleep, nausea, anxiety, and the pain that was beginning to grip her womb, and he fervently wished that this night would never end. "Do you think I'll be able to have children?" she finally asked. "I suppose so," he replied. "But try to find them a responsible father." They both smiled with relief. Amanda searched Jaime's dark face, which was leaning over her, for signs of some resemblance to Nicolás, but found none. For the first time in her nomadic existence, she felt protected and safe. She gave a sigh of contentment and forgot all about the sordid surroundings, the peeling walls, the cold metal cupboards, the dreadful instruments, the smell of disinfectant, and even that raucous pain that had settled inside her. "Please lie down next to me and hold me," she said. He lay down timidly on the narrow bed, wrapping his arms around her. He concentrated on being as still as he could so as not to disturb her and not to fall. He had the awkward tenderness of someone who has never been loved and is forced to improvise. Amanda closed her eyes and smiled. They lay there breathing together in utter calm, like brother and sister, until day began to break and the light from the window became stronger than the light of the lamp. Then Jaime helped her to her feet, put her coat around her shoulders, and led her by the arm to the waiting room, where Nicolas had spent the night sleeping in a chair.
"Wake up," Jaime said. "We're going to take her home so Mama can look after her. It's better for her not to be alone for a few days."
"I knew we could count on you," Nicolas replied, his voice breaking with gratitude.
"I didn't do it for you, creep. I did it for her," Jaime growled, turning his back on his brother.
Clara let them into the big house on the corner without asking any questions, or perhaps she had already asked them of her cards or the spirits. They had had to wake her, because the sun was just coming up and everyone was still asleep.
"Mama, you have to help Amanda,"
Jaime pleaded, with the certainty that came from their complicity in matters such as this. "She's sick, and she needs to stay here a few days."
"What about little Miguel?"
Amanda asked.
"I'll go get him," Nicolas replied, and he left.
They prepared one of the guest rooms, and Amanda got into bed. Jaime took her temperature and said she ought to rest. He started to go out, but remained in the doorway, leaning against the frame, still undecided. Just then, Clara returned with a tray of coffee for the three of them.
"I suppose we owe you an explanation, Mama," Jaime murmured as they drank their coffee.
"No, son," Clara answered gaily. "If it's a sin, I'd rather not know about it. Let's use the occasion to pamper Amanda. She needs it."
Her son followed her out.
Jaime looked at his mother a few paces ahead of him in the hallway, barefoot, her loose hair hanging down her back, and wrapped in her white bathrobe, and he realized that she was not as tall and strong as she had seemed to him in childhood. He reached out and took her by the shoulder. She turned around and smiled, and Jaime hugged her compulsively, clasping her to his chest and scratching her forehead with his chin, whose impossible beard was already clamoring for a shave. It was the first time he had embraced her spontaneously since he was a tiny baby rooted to her breast by need, and Clara was astonished to see how big her son had become. He had the thorax of a weightlifter and a pair of arms like hammers that could crush her with a terrifying force. Stirred and happy, she wondered how it was possible that this hairy giant, with the strength of a bear and the candor of a novitiate, could have ever lain inside her belly, especially as one of two. During the next few days, Amanda ran a fever. Shaken, Jaime kept constant watch and gave her sulfa drugs. Clara tended her. She couldn't fail to notice that Nicolas discreetly asked about her but made no attempt to visit her. Jaime, on the other hand, lent her his favorite books and walked around like someone in a trance, babbling incoherently and crisscrossing the house as he had never done before. On Thursday night, he forgot his socialist meeting. Thus, for a little while, Amanda became a member of the family, and Miguel, through exceptional circumstances, was present, hidden in a wardrobe, the day Alba was born in the Treva house. He never forgot the grandiose, terrible sight of that tiny child entering the world, coated with all her bloody membranes, between the shrieks of her mother and the cries of the women bustling around her. Meanwhile, Esteban Treva had left on a trip to the United States. Tired of the pain in his bones and the secret illness that only he perceived, he had decided it was time to be examined by foreign doctors. He had reached the premature conclusion that Latin doctors were all charlatans who were closer to sorcerers than scientists. His shrinking was so infinitesimal, so slow and so sly, that no one other than himself had noticed it. He had to buy shoes one size smaller, shorten his trousers, and have a tuck taken in his shirt sleeves. One day, he put on the black hat he had not worn all summer, and it covered his ears completely, which led him to deduce that if his brain was shrinking, his ideas were also probably withering away. The gringo doctors measured his body, weighed each piece of him separately, interrogated him in English, injected liquids into him with one needle and extracted them with another, photographed him, turned him inside out like a glove, and even stuck a light up his anus. In the end, they concluded that it was all in his mind, that there was no reason for him to believe that he was shrinking, that he had always been the same size, but that perhaps he had dreamt that he was once 6 feet tall and wore a size 12 shoe. Esteban Trueba lost patience and returned to his country, prepared to ignore the problem of his height, since all great politicians in history had been small, from Napoleon to Hitler. When he arrived at his house, he saw Miguel playing in the garden, and Amanda, thinner and with deep bags under her eyes, stripped of her makeup and her bracelets, sitting with Jaime on the terrace. He asked no questions, for he was accustomed to seeing total strangers living under his roof. 8. The Count. Had it not been for the letters Clara and Blanca exchanged, that entire period would have remained submerged in a jumble of faded, time-worn memories. Their abundant correspondence salvaged events for the mists of improbable facts. From the very first letter she received from her daughter after her wedding, Clara could tell that her separation from Blanca would not last long. Without saying a word to anyone, she prepared one of the largest, sunniest rooms in the house. In it she placed the bronze cradle in which her own 3 children had slept. Blanca was never able to explain to her mother why she had agreed to marry, because she herself did not know. Analyzing her past when she had reached middle age, she decided that the main reason was her fear of her father. Ever since she was a child, she had been familiar with the irrational strength of his anger, and she was used to obeying him. In the end, her pregnancy and the news of Pedro III's death decided her. Still, from the moment she accepted the liaison with Jean de Satigny, she knew that she would never consummate the marriage. She would invent every possible argument for postponing their union. At first, relying on the discomforts peculiar to her state, and afterward, finding additional excuses, because she was convinced that it would be far easier to manage a husband like the Count, who wore kid-skin shoes, polished his fingernails, and was willing to marry a woman pregnant with someone else's child, than to oppose a father like Esteban Trueba. Of 2 evils, she chose the one that struck her as the lesser. She realized that there was a commercial arrangement between the French Count and her father in which she had no say. In exchange for a surname for his grandchild, Trueba gave Jean de Satigny a rich dowry and the promise that he would eventually receive an inheritance. Blanca lent herself to their negotiations, but she was not prepared to surrender either her love or her intimacy to her husband, because she was still in love with Pedro III, more out of force of habit than out of any hope of ever seeing him again. Blanca and her new husband spent their wedding night in the honeymoon suite of the best hotel in the capital, which Trueba had filled with flowers in the hope of winning his daughter's forgiveness for the string of assaults to which he had subjected her during the preceding months. To her great surprise, there was no need for her to feign a migraine. As soon as they were alone together, Jean shed his role as the eager suitor who had planted furtive kisses on her neck and who had chosen the finest shrimp to put into her mouth one by one. It was as if he had thoroughly forgotten his seductive, silent movie idol manner and become instead the brother he had been to her in the days of their country strolls, when they would spread their picnic lunch on the ground and take photographs and read aloud in French. Jean disappeared into the bathroom, where he stayed so long that by the time he returned to the bedroom, Blanca was half asleep. She thought she must be dreaming when she saw that her husband had changed out of his wedding suit into black silk pajamas and a velvet Pompeian bathrobe. He had put a net over his impeccably waved hair and reeked of eau de cologne. He seemed to have no great amatory impatience. He sat down beside her on the bed and began to stroke her cheek with the same half-mocking touch he had used on earlier occasions. Then, in his affected, or less Spanish, he proceeded to explain that he had no particular inclination for married life, being in love only with the arts, literature, and scientific curiosities, and therefore had no intention of disturbing her with the usual demands of a husband. They could live together, but not entwined, in perfect harmony and decorum. Relieved, Blanca threw her arms around his neck and kissed him on both cheeks. "Thank you, Jean," she exclaimed. "You're welcome," he replied courteously. They settled into the large Empire-style bed, talking about the wedding party and making plans for their future life. "Don't you want to know who the father of my child is?" Blanca asked. "I am," Jean replied, kissing her on the forehead. They each slept on their own side of the bed, back to back. At 5 o'clock in the morning, Blanca awoke with an upset stomach from the cloyingly sweet smell of the flowers with which her father had adorned the nuptial chamber. Jean de Satigny helped her to the bathroom, supported her while she leaned over the toilet, led her back to bed, and put the flowers out in the hall. Afterward, he was unable to fall back to sleep, and spent the rest of the night reading La Philosophie dans le Boudoir of the Marquis de Sade, while Blanca sighed through her dreams that it was marvelous to be married to an intellectual. The next day, Jean went to the bank to cash a check from his father-in-law and spent nearly the whole day going from one store to another, buying the attire he considered appropriate to his new economic position. Meanwhile, bored with waiting for him in the hotel lobby, Blanca decided to pay a visit to her mother. She put on her best morning hat and took a cab to the big house on the corner, where the rest of her family was eating in silence, still irritable and tired from the upheaval of the wedding and the after effects of their recent fights. When he saw her enter the dining room, her father gave a shout of horror. "What are you doing here?" he roared.
"Nothing. I've come to see you," Blanca murmured, terrified.
"You're out of your mind. Don't you realize that if anybody sees you, they're going to say that your husband sent you home in the middle of your honeymoon? They'll think you weren't a virgin."
"But I wasn't, Papa."
Esteban was about to strike her in the face, but Jaime stood between them with such firmness that Esteban resigned himself to insulting her for her stupidity. Clara, unshakable, led Blanca to a chair and served her a plate of cold fish with caper sauce, while Esteban continued screaming and Nicolás went to get the car to return her to her husband. The two women whispered just like in old times. That same afternoon, Blanca and Jean took the train to the port, where they boarded an English ocean liner. He was wearing white linen trousers with a blue jacket styled like a sailor's, which went beautifully with the blue skirt and white jacket of his wife's tailored suit. 4 days later, the vessel deposited them in the farthest province of the north, where their elegant travel attire and crocodile bags went unnoticed in the dry, suffocating heat of the siesta. Jean de Satigny settled his wife provisionally in a hotel and turned his attention to the task of finding them lodgings worthy of his new status. Within 24 hours, the small provincial society world knew that an authentic count had arrived in their midst. This did much to advance Jean's cause. He was able to rent an ancient mansion that had belonged to one of the great saltpeter fortunes before they invented the synthetic substitute that had shot the whole industry to hell. The house was somewhat musty and abandoned, like everything in sight, and needed a number of repairs, but its former dignity and the fin de siècle charms were intact. The Count decorated it according to his personal taste, with a decadent, ambiguous refinement that startled Blanca. Accustomed as she was to country life and her father's classical sobriety, Jean brought in suspicious Chinese porcelain vases that, instead of flowers, held dyed ostrich feathers, damask curtains with pleats and tassels, cushions with fringe and pompons, furniture of every style,
Gold room dividers and screens and several incredible standing lamps held aloft by life-sized ceramic statues of half-naked Abyssinian Negroes wearing turbans and slippers with upturned toes. The curtains were almost always drawn, leaving the house in a tenuous darkness that kept the cruel desert light at bay. In the corners, Jean had placed oriental incense burners, in which he burnt special perfumed herbs and sticks of incense that at first turned Blanca's stomach, but to which she quickly became accustomed. He hired several Indians to work for him, in addition to a monumentally fat woman cook, whom he taught to make the spicy sauces that he was so fond of, and a lame, illiterate maid to wait on Blanca. They were all outfitted with showy uniforms that looked like costumes from an operetta, but he was unable to make them wear shoes because they were accustomed to going barefoot and could not adjust. Blanca was uncomfortable in the house. She did not trust the expressionless Indians who waited on her with such evident ill will and seemed to make fun of her behind her back. They moved around her like ghosts, gliding soundlessly through the rooms, almost always bored and empty-handed. They never answered when she spoke to them, as if they did not understand Spanish, and when they spoke among themselves, they always whispered or used one of the mountain dialects. Whenever Blanca told her husband the strange things she had observed among the servants, he replied that they were Indian customs to which she should pay no heed. Clara gave her the same answer in a letter. After Blanca wrote that one day she had seen one of the Indians standing in a pair of astonishing antique shoes with twisted heels and velvet laces, in which the man's broad, calloused feet had got stuck. The heat of the desert, your pregnancy, and your unconscious desire to live like a countess, in accordance with your husband's lineage, are making you see things, darling, Clara wrote in jest, adding that the best cure for Louis XV shoes was a cold shower and a cup of chamomile tea. Another time, Blanca found a small dead lizard on her plate, which she was about to put in her mouth. When she recovered from the shock and managed to regain her voice, she called for the cook and pointed to the plate with a trembling finger. The cook approached, her mountainous fat and her braids swaying, and picked up the plate without a word. But as she turned around, Blanca could have sworn she caught a wink of complicity between her husband and the cook. That night she lay awake very late, wondering about what she had seen, until she finally concluded that she had imagined it. Her mother was right. The heat and her pregnancy were affecting her mind. The farthest rooms in the house were allocated to Jean's mania for photography. In them he set up his lights, his tripods, and his various machines. He begged Blanca never to enter what he called his laboratory without permission, because, he explained, the plates could be destroyed by natural light. He installed a lock on the door and carried the key everywhere he went on a gold watch chain, a completely useless precaution, since his wife had practically no interest in her surroundings, much less in the art of photography. The larger she grew, the deeper Blanca sat into an oriental placidity that dashed all her husband's attempts to introduce her into society. He wanted to take her to parties, to drive her around by car, and involve her in the decoration of her new house. But Blanca, heavy, torpid, solitary, and the victim of an unshakable fatigue, took refuge in her knitting and embroidery. She slept most of the day, and spent her few waking hours sewing tiny articles of clothing for a complete pink wardrobe, for she was convinced that her baby would be a girl. As her mother had done with her, she developed a whole system for communicating with the infant that was growing inside her, turning in on herself in a silent, uninterrupted dialogue. Her letters described her secluded, melancholy life, and she referred to her husband with blind sympathy as a fine, discreet, considerate man. Thus, without ever setting out to do so, she set in motion the myth that Jean de Satigny was practically a prince.
never mentioning the fact that he spent his afternoons inhaling cocaine and smoking opium, because she was sure her parents would not understand. She had a whole wing of the house to herself. There she had arranged her headquarters and begun to pile up all the things she was preparing for her.